Good morning. This morning, I want to talk about the Buddhist teaching of totality, which is not an easy thing to talk about in the sense that we really can't talk about it. It's not an object of our mind. It isn't something that we can see as an object or understand as an object. In order for us to see totality and to realize the totality as something, some reality, some object of mind, we would have to be outside of totality. But if we were outside of totality, then we don't have totality because we're outside of totality. So this is very difficult for us. Of course, this totality is reality, is the truth, with a capital T. It is Dharma, reality before we get some ideas and notions about reality. As we stand apart from totality and discuss it, or think of it as some kind of object of mind, then we're just talking about the idea of totality. And of course I'll be talking about the idea of totality, but I don't want to just talk about the idea of totality. I want to indicate totality itself, point to totality itself, which we can't know as an object of mind. In the Huayan teachings of Buddhism, which deal very much with this matter of totality, here they talk about, well, they have this teaching of the 10 coins. And they're talking about some object there. We take a coin, and there's some object, and there are other coins. If we talk about coin number one, then there are 9 other coins. Totality would be all 10 coins. So this is how we talk about totality, in ways like this. Because as I mentioned, we can't talk about it directly. But through talking in this way, we can kind of point to how we actually experience totality, which we do, but we experience it directly, not as an idea. So in teaching in this way, using the 10 coins, the 10 coins just represent the world of this and that. There's many different things here in totality. Of course, like coins, they're very distinct. We have coin number one, coin number two, coin number three, and so on. But if we were to enumerate all the things, ideas, thoughts, feelings, entities that exist in totality, we couldn't do it because we can always draw the lines in different places. Where does something begin? Where does something end? Where do you begin? Where did you end? Does anything really begin or end? And, of course, we can say, well, I mean here. We're going to define it here. But now, of course, there's something outside of the line that we drew. Well, totality will include that. No matter how you carve it up, totality is speaking of what is on both sides of the line that you drew. These lines that we draw, this is our conceptualizing mind. This is consciousness at work, drawing lines, making distinctions, and carving up this realm of totality into this and that. And consciousness can always work to redraw the lines. There aren't any lines. There aren't any distinct lines that actually exist in some real way, in some objective way, that don't change, that are always there. These are the correct boundaries of this idea, that thought, that's how it is, this object, whatever. However we want to carve up the world and discuss the different parts, the different coins of the world. But one of the things, I meant to say this before I got this far, was one of the things that we can observe about totality directly, because we might say, well, if it's not an object of mind, how do we know there is such a thing? Well, the thing we can observe about totality or reality or the truth or Dharma directly is here it is. There's something going on here. That this is not anything mysterious here. There's something taking place. In other words, this is mind that's taking place here. The mind is switched on. This is not a blank nothingness. There is sound and color and feeling and thought. This is experienced now, directly. This is mind. This is the operation of mind. One of the operations within mind is this consciousness which is dividing all of this. But the thing that is undeniable, the thing that doesn't need to be verified, is there is mind. There is this reality. This reality that is mind is this very same totality. And it can be observed directly. The problem that we have is that because of the functioning of consciousness dividing up this totality into this and that, we become infatuated with the different objects that appear, thinking that somehow they exist in isolation as entities unto themselves, separate and apart from other things. We just see it this way. We're taken in by it. If our attention is drawn to it, we might realize that actually maybe things don't exist just like that, separate from other things, separate things unto themselves. But this is kind of a subtle point, and that even after our attention is drawn to it, and maybe drawn to it again repeatedly, and perhaps even repeatedly for many years, we are the objects of our consciousness are so compellingly real as objects unto themselves that we still tend to see things in this way. And in seeing things in this way, we cannot now understand or realize or understand what the direct experience of totality is before we do this, before we conceptualize. So we have these teachings, like the teachings of the 10 coins, that kind of help us out with this problem that we have. And it goes something like this, that if we say we reduce the entire universe to just these 10 coins, so we've made a very simplified model of reality now. Instead of this huge, vast, complex, and ancient universe, we've now just reduced it down. The only thing that exists are these 10 coins. That's it. That's totality. Now, were we to remove one of these coins from totality, then of course we don't have totality. If you were one of the coins that's stepping out of totality now to look at totality, you realize that what you're looking at, the other 9 coins, isn't totality. You see, that's why we can't see totality directly. So we have to put that coin back in there. What the awakened see is that the universe always exists in this way. It exists in totality. That the mind exists in totality. Of course, we start talking about mind and we start thinking in terms of our mind, my mind. But you see, your mind is just one of the things. And as I mentioned before, too, until we look at it, even just casually, you just start to look at it a little bit, we start to notice that this thing that we just glibly tossed off is my mind, as if it had very clear and distinct boundaries. As soon as you look at that a little bit, you realize, well, that isn't very clear at all. What exactly is your mind? Well, that's because we don't have any distinct boundaries there. We can't really distinguish our mind from other things. But that's what's going on in this realm of the 10 coins. They're all inextricably together somehow. I was going to say connected, but not even necessarily connected, because there's no separation there even in the first place. So what we have as reality is the 10 coins. Nothing can be removed. What we have in reality is all this vast, complex experience. And we think that somehow our mind is taking readings on it, but that's understanding and imagining as if somehow your mind were removed from it and now taking in. We are overlooking the fact that what we're calling our mind It's just part of this universe of the 10 coins. And so what we mean by mind, then, is not something like my mind. When we speak of totality or reality as mind, we're speaking of the 10 coins. We're not speaking of your mind at all. We're speaking of reality as a whole. It seems odd, of course, to us to speak of reality as a whole as mind. But once again, if we just take a look at what our actual immediate experience is before we lay a lot of heavy thought and thinking on it, if we just look at it directly, we realize that it is mental. That our experience is purely mental. We think that there are other aspects of it that aren't mental at all. You know, the physical material universe is not mental. Well, we think in this way, but that's something that's removed from the totality of what is actually being experienced. What is actually being experienced, if you just look at it right on the face of it, and in its depths, is purely mental. Our experience of the floor is a mental experience. It is mind. And no aspect of this experience can be removed. This is why in Zen teachings we say that nothing is removed from the mind. The mind contains everything. It contains everything not as a collection of things. It contains everything as everything. It is everything. Your mind, remember, just being one of the things. And not even one of the particular things. Because your mind is not something that's staying put. Of course, neither is anything else. Coin number one doesn't remain coin number one. Coin number one doesn't persist. Nor does coin number two. If your mind is coin number three, that doesn't persist either. And coin number three can't exist without coin number two. Because they exist in totality. And we never have anything removed from totality. If anything were removed from totality, we're speaking nonsense now. We're speaking of something that just doesn't exist at all. We speak in many ways based on our assumption of separation and difference, and based on our assumption of the reality of the parts, the 10 coins, ignoring the actual direct reality of mind or totality. And when we speak in this way, then we become very confused. And we see separation where there isn't any separation. We see ourselves as separate from our actual experience, which, of course, is very absurd. But we see ourselves as something removed, and we experience loneliness. We experience wanting. We experience, some kind of fleeting satisfaction of getting what we want, but it's fleeting, and then we're wanting again. We experience fear because we think that something will be removed from us, such as, say, our life. Which is another one of the coins. Here's me, and then there's my life. We think like that, as if somehow my life were something other than me, and somehow we're fearful that perhaps our life will be taken from us someday. Well, it's not even perhaps; it's as certain as taxes, right? If you think that way, if you see things in that way. But, of course, this way of seeing things is based on the assumption that we actually have a separation here in the first place. This is confusion. So we see things as though there's a separation when there isn't any separation. And when there is difference, we don't see that as a difference. We see that as a sameness. In fact, our communication occurs very much in that way. I say something, and then you listen, and then you receive some idea, and you think that you have the idea that I was offering, when, of course, that isn't the case. Suzuki Roshi, I think it was in Zen Man Beginner's Mind, where he says, I forget how it is, but he says, he's talking about the bird. And he says, of course, what I mean by bird is not what you mean by bird. I think he was speaking of totality there. He sees the bird in totality. Not even the bird in totality. He sees the bird as totality. But whether he sees the bird as totality or not, it is different from what you see when you see the bird. Of course, to the extent that we do see the bird, we all see it differently. We do. To the extent that we speak of the bird, we're all speaking of something separate. Nevertheless, we talk in a way where we think we're actually sharing something here and exchanging something, as if what I mean is what you now understand, when in fact this never occurs. So it's kind of like we go through life having it all backwards, where there's identity and sameness and oneness and totality. We're oblivious to that. And where we think that there's a connection being made, we don't realize that this is all formed of our distinctions. Of course, these distinctions are all artificially created and made by us, but we do it in a very quick and glib manner, where we're not really aware of the fact that we're doing this. That is why we're deceived into thinking that when we say something, that what I mean has been now received by you and you understand what I mean. Of course, we do understand each other well enough, I think, that we can get along and communicate. But this communication has more to do with wholeness and totality than it does with one person communicating to another. The communication we have is with totality, and this is what we actually understand. And it's kind of like our voice is being beamed up to that satellite of totality, except it isn't. That's a bad analogy. Forget that. It's just a direction pointing to totality. It's no direction at all. And then we receive our understanding back through that. This is when we actually communicate. This is how I think artists communicate in this way. And to the extent that art is great, that it really moves us, is when it points, draws our attention directly to reality, totality itself. It's not in the painting or the poetry or the whatever it is we're discussing here, the music. It is in the fact that it has drawn our attention to what is truly real. And we understand that. And it moves our heart. And this is real communication. But you see, this isn't even communication that's being transmitted now. This is direct communication. It is the direct understanding of no separation. And this moves us very, very deeply. And to the extent that the artist can create this in us, we call that great art. Sometimes it's hard to tell if the great art, you know, when the great art is produced yesterday, it might be just speaking to our thinking, to the current fads and fashions of the moment. 20 years from now, 100 years from now, nobody is impressed by that. It just reeks and stinks of its own small circle. But the thing that does speak in a profound way, gradually, slowly, that will begin to move the heart. And if 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 400 years from now, it still moves the heart. Now we have a pretty good chance that we're looking at something that's truly great here. But again, it is our immediate, I don't want to say connection, but oneness with reality, with the truth, with totality that is speaking to us. And we all have an ear and an eye for this. Particularly if we can let our own personal eye and ear, a little ego, and quiet down a little bit, and not be too concerned with our own communication. I want you to understand what I mean, and I want to know, what do you expect of me? This is all too much, too noisy for us much of the time. And so we feel separation. We feel separation even while there isn't really any separation. If we were a little quiet and take a more careful note of our actual immediate direct experience, we would realize that. And then maybe like the great artist, we can, we're moved to paint something, to write something, to say something that that has the effect of drawing the eye, the ear, to noticing our actual immediate direct experience. Well, this totality, another term we use is wholeness. Let's just say one more thing about it here. Actually, this was the thing I wanted to say about it. A few weeks ago, I gave a talk on the three monkeys. You know, hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. And I pointed out there how we don't, in Buddhism, we don't think of evil as something that's removed and separate from what is good. It's very dualistic. That is to see things in our ordinary fracture way, our conceptualizing way, and to not see things in terms of totality. To see things in terms of totality is to see that there's this difference and distinction that can be made between that which is fractured or intellectualized or conceptualized or whatever, and that which is actually being experienced directly, which is a truth, reality. And that is the wholeness, the totality that is being experienced directly. So another word for this whole totality or wholeness, I suppose we could say, is good. I usually don't like to use that term at this point because we're so used to thinking of, in terms of good, in this dualistic way of good as opposed to evil. But as long as we keep seeing good in that way, we have to realize that good is actually behaving very much like what we're otherwise calling evil. It's just a separate thing, as if these two things were at war with each other. And we don't get anywhere with that. Because both of these refer to, or are coming out of, a leaning mind, a grasping mind, a mind filled with intention of trying to defeat the other, to improve this situation, to banish the other. If we have a mind for totality, we realize that you cannot banish the other. It always remains. And as long as you keep fighting with it, you will keep revving that one up to being this big threatening thing that you think you need to wipe out. So we don't look at it in that way. We try to train ourselves, bring ourselves back to looking at it in this more magnanimous way. Because in this way, then our mind, our own separate little ego self here, which normally is kind of calling all the shots for us, we're seeing everything in terms of that, we can begin to let that go a little bit and take on the qualities of actual mind itself, which is the mind of totality or the whole that I spoke of earlier. And in seeing it in this way, this is the mind of goodness or the whole. This is really truly to practice what is good. Sometimes when we're confused about this issue, like for example, I should have looked up the etymology of this word, but I believe, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think the term God is etymologically related to the term good, right? I think. I might be wrong. If I'm wrong, it doesn't matter. What I got to say will still work. Because we generally think, though, of God as good. But if you see God as other, as a separate entity, of course, then we'll even carry it to a more extreme, where we start to personify God as a separate entity. Not only as a separate entity, but as a personality. And then, of course, now as a personality, having the same kind of qualities of mind that we do. In other words, an ego. And God has will. And of course, we might presume that we can get to know God and get to know God's will, not just for me, but for you. And I can start to tell you what God wants you to do. We start talking in very nonsensical ways like this. Well, God, if God is good, good cannot have these kinds of qualities. It leads us to all kinds of problems, like if we have this notion of God, this entity that is all good and all knowing and all powerful, well, by now I think everybody knows that you can't have these three qualities in one thing. because we wouldn't have this universe. So something's got to go in this picture. An all-knowing, all-powerful God. We have different ways of tweaking it. You know, that, well, God just kind of set and let it run and now left, gave us free will, etc. There's all kinds of problems. None of these philosophies and theologies are satisfying. They're flawed. They will not bring the heart. If we're really honest with ourselves, if we don't allow ourselves to be lulled into some kind of wishful thinking about this, we can see that this cannot be how the universe is set up. It just isn't set up this way. That God, if God means what is good, God cannot have will. Because will is something that comes out of the fractured mind. The mind that wants some particular thing to come about. No, this mind is the mind of the whole. It is the mind of totality. It is the mind that controls the falling leaf from the tree. It doesn't do it through intention. And it finds that perfect spot to nourish the forest, to allow life to come forth on this planet. This is the working of the whole. We come in with our intention. We want to arrange it. We want to make it a little bit better. Pretty soon we're polluting the rivers. We're polluting the atmosphere. God or totality doesn't do this. Well, I suppose you could say a volcano goes off. But on the whole, this isn't how it operates. So this is a very important point, because a very profound confusion that we have about this matter of goodness, good and evil, God, and all these kinds of things. Our problem is that we have not removed ourselves from our own small little mind, and always putting everything in characteristic and in terms of our own separate ego mind. And now trying to understand totality or wholeness or goodness through that, with that starting point. It doesn't work, and in the end it leaves us basically confused. Of course, we might construct a very nice philosophy of life, a religion or this or that, get enough people believing it, and we can kind of muddle through. Well, it's muddy. But we have the capacity to see the truth directly ourselves. Not in the form of an idea, not in the form of some written document of some kind. The holy truth. It isn't something that's written down. It is something to be seen directly. It is immediate, and it is totality. And everything is included. Nothing is left out. There's no need to feel lonely, coldness and separation, because nothing's ever removed from you. This is a heart of true compassion, because it is the heart of true understanding of what our actual circumstance is. That short of this understanding, there's some part of compassion that's lopped off. Of course, we have a good heart. We want to be good. We want to help people. We want to be kind to people. Of course, this is our deep feeling. But how are we really going to live in this way? As truly, truly good, truly kind, compassionate. It is that we have to drop this little self and see what the actual experience is before we carve it up in that way and separate ourselves. Then we can understand good. Then we have an idea. Well, again, God is another word that I generally don't want to use. It's not a perfectly fine word, I suppose, but has so many connotations, you know, surrounding it, that it's best to leave that alone. So I generally don't like to use that word. But if what we mean by God is truth, is reality, and we want to get in touch with, that's what religion is about, is to reunite, to rebind with what is actually true and real. This is the meaning of religion. And it's not about believing something, getting another, that's a fractured thing. It's just another idea. No, it is about seeing directly, immediately, what the truth is. And we can do this. In fact, you are already doing it. You're doing it now. It is impossible for you not to be directly perceiving the truth all the time. But for the fact that we overlay our immediate experience with our thinking, we would see just what this is. This is a very serious matter, because it really gets right down to the very heart of what the cause and the, or what can I say, what the tangled mass of human suffering is. It's because we don't understand this very simple thing. And it is very simple. But this is what the Buddhist teaching of totality is about. Very subtle teaching. We have to come to it slowly, maybe repeatedly, let it sink in. Because there isn't any particular thing there to grasp. The thing that we will quickly grasp like that is just another fractured thing. But at some point, maybe we can, before we grasp, we can begin to realize what is actually going on. And realize that we don't need to grasp in that way. Well, I think that's all I got to say about totality this morning. There's a lot more to be said about totality, as you might guess. But that's probably enough. Do you have any questions or comments or arguments? Mike?
As far as the classics are concerned, how can you let our ideas drop away?
How can we let our ideas drop away? You have to be careful of that. It's not that we have to do anything about letting our ideas drop away. We need a lot of our ideas. You need them on the job. You need them to get to your job. You gotta have some concept of how to get from your house to work, you know. So it isn't like these things are bad and we need to get rid of them. But we should begin to realize what their limitations are, and that they're only helpful in a relative sense, that our notions and ideas don't say anything ultimately about our circumstance here and our situation and how we can understand and realize how to get along. We start to realize that, then you might think that there aren't that many times that you reach for that, using your little idea, your fractured, your conceptual ideas about truth and reality. No, we're doing that actually all the time. I would say 85% of the thinking we do is fouled in that way, fouled in the sense of being fouled up. And we don't know that. In other words, we think that we're dealing with truth. We think that we're dealing with the way things are. We think that we're actually conveying something meaningful to the next person. Well, we are. They're receiving meaning, but it isn't your meaning. You know, and we'll make, which isn't to say that we shouldn't attempt to communicate in this sort of thing, but to the extent that we notice the limitations of this, we will back out of our own small mind, back off from our own agenda, and actually realize the direct, immediate communication which is there, which is coming through wholeness and totality. But how do we do this? It's just a matter of noticing, I think, the limitations. It's not a matter of forcing yourself to drop this idea or that idea, but just notice what these ideas are connected to and what they bring about. And also notice to what extent we hold them in such a way that as if they were ultimately real, or that we kind of steer our lives, carve out our own agenda based on these kinds of notions. This is a way that we entangle ourselves in suffering and confusion. You know? So it's simply, just very simply then, it's just a matter of seeing, just noticing this. Notice how we needlessly complicate our lives. I don't really think there's anything about this practice that requires real force and struggle and strain and effort in that way. The Buddha spoke of right effort. Right effort is just simply to turn our mind to wholeness. Turn our mind to wholeness and totality. Just bring ourselves back. If you notice you're slipping into the little fractured world of your own creation, see if you can just notice that. Because if you really start to notice it, you'll start to notice how painful that is, how unsatisfying that is. And quite naturally, we back out of that. You become more and more familiar with this, and you're less likely to go running off in that direction. And gradually, we can really move way back. There's freedom in it. And peace. Yeah, John.
Well, the teaching of the Ten Coins seems rather profound. You think that removing any coin, remove it to where? Becomes a meaningless process.
Yeah, it is meaningless.
That's another thinking idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in reality, we cannot remove any one of the coins. Because if we didn't have totality, then there's nothing going on. But of course, there is. Therefore, it's all going on.
But the aspect of where did you remove it?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, even for you to do that, you also have to be removed. But the way we live our lives through our conceptualizing, we are removed. That's what the conceptualized view is, that I'm removed, I'm separate, you see. But that's, and it's not that that's wrong or bad. Like I said, we need our concepts and things. But realize that, strictly speaking, you can't really say that you are, or that there's even this thing called you. We truly can't find any of these things. So our experience involves all of this. That's totality. It has, illusion and delusion. This is all part of totality. In other words, it's all part of goodness. But by getting a little bit more familiar with the workings of totality, of mind itself, apart from our own agenda, we can live in a more painless way, a way that causes a little bit less trouble, difficulty for both ourselves and others. And then maybe eventually we can actually wake up. So, anything else?
Do you think the word God was, I don't even know when it was first used in this language. All the different manifestations of Yahweh and so on. That at first it was an attempt to express that totality, and then, of course, it got picked up and played around with and molded, and then all these relative things were created out of it. Certainly, there are some uses of the word that seem to be attempts to express totality in the same kind of poetic or artistic ways.
You mean like Yahweh?
Well,
of course, not that, because that's pronounced, but
right,
the word cannot. Yeah.
It's the proxy for the word that can't even be said.
It can't be said, right?
Mm-hmm. What would you say about that?
Well, I suppose the term God, I really don't know, so I don't know if I can say too much. But I think these notions came out of our thinking. That there were spirits that moved each individual, entity that existed, and then we have this notion of kind of oneness that starts creeping into the picture, and one God, etc. Yeah, I think this is probably coming from the fact that deep down, we all know that this is the case, and so when we encounter something like that, it seems there's something right about it, but because we're so confused, we keep mishandling it. And then we keep throwing our own little fractured kinds of approaches to things onto this thing that we sense is there. Like even when we talk about wholeness and dharma and totality and things like this, we keep treating it as though it's just another one of the things. And as long as we keep thinking in these terms, we don't really see what we've got here. To what extent did people in different traditions see that? I think some have, and I think that there's been subtle ways that this has been pointed to. But on the whole, I think it's been badly handled, mishandled, and I think even so today. I think it's just simply the case that it's because the objects of our mind are so compellingly real that they dominate, and we don't see the fact that this is all taking place within one whole piece here, as reality itself, with no you there separate from it. This is one of the reasons that I do honor, here's my prejudice coming out now, but it's the reason I was drawn to Buddhism, that I felt that the Buddhist teaching of no self, I think, is the most direct pointing and clarification of what the snag point is here. How is it that we keep missing this? I think the Buddha really was able to point to that, and having clear insight into just what the problem is. But as all of us who have looked at this teaching know, if we don't just dismiss it out of hand as a bunch of nonsense, like, no self, come on, you kid, it first strikes us that way. I know it struck me that way as a kid when I first encountered it, actually. I thought it was kind of foolish. Fortunately, I had an older brother who was kind of taken by it. So it gave me the impression that, I respected him, you see, so maybe there's something to this. So it kind of left the door open for me later on when I got a little older and started looking at this. But it is this, I think that teaching of the Buddha clarified somewhat with the works of Nagarjuna and others that really point to this directly. Without that understanding of our experience, to the extent that we still keep thinking, say, of this God or goodness or whatever as another entity, we don't get there. We have to see it, but we have to transcend that kind of split, that kind of dualism, that kind of duality. But yeah, I think there are readings that you could take on different kind of literature from different traditions and from the Bible and elsewhere that indicate that, yeah, there might be some people there who had this sense, but it's always left in the hands of the many who don't understand. And the same is true in Buddhism. All throughout its history and even today, most of it is left in the hands of people who really don't really understand the depth of this teaching. And I suppose that's kind of too bad, but that's just how it is. We have this image in Zen of the fur and the horns. You don't know the fur and the horns? It's about this very point. The fur is many, and the horns are few. And the horns are those...
F-U-R,
yeah. It's kind of like you have the deer, It's a lot of fur, a lot of fur there. But a few horns. And the horns are few, see. But I think, too, this is my own... I'll give my own personal thing here, that I think maybe in time, these teachings, if we don't kill ourselves off first, just through having so much now power and technology to do such a thing, and ethically, morally, we're still very backward. And yet we have all this tremendous power. We can literally now annihilate ourselves. It's one of the reasons I'm writing that book right now. Something has to be said about this. But I think that over time, we can learn to perfect these teachings in such a way, and that humankind can evolve or mature, grow up, where we get past this horrible kind of stage in our adolescence where we now know how to drive the car, but we have no sense about how to obey the speed limit or whatever else. We have to get through this. And we're not going to get through it unless we understand the subtlety of this teaching. And so I think that maybe there are ways we can learn, you know, to make this teaching very clear, so it is not that hard to mistake it. But I think that this is what needs to be done. Because otherwise we are headed for extinction as a species. Of course there are other planets, other worlds. But come on. I think we need to do some work ourselves. Well, I really drifted quite a ways from your question, I think, but maybe we've run out of time now. What time is it? 8 minutes? We still have 8 minutes? To the end of the hour, you mean? Yes.
Christianity is talking about surrendering your will to God. It seems like God hears reality. God hears this moment. Mm-hmm. Surrendering your will to this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a little more sense.
Yeah. But it's not a matter that's an example there of a teaching which can be very badly handled. But at the same time, you can look at that teaching and you know, there could be a very profound understanding of what's at work here. But the thing is, it's surrender. Of course, how do you surrender your will? That's an act of will, you see, and you really can't do that. It isn't a matter of, this is what I was saying before, this is what I meant by, this isn't really a matter of struggling and striving and straining. It is a matter of seeing. And if we see what this is, then our will to act in this partisan, or well, not partisan, but this fractured way, is you know, out of our own personal thing, it drops away. It literally drops away. It isn't acting anymore. And it doesn't totally, you know, it can be there and not be there, but that begins to weaken and drop away. We cannot use our will. We cannot drive it into the ground, you know, and force it to stop. It just doesn't work that way. So again, this is a teaching that could be pointing to, and in surrender your will to totality. Yeah, that's another way too of kind of, in a strange way, you're beefing up the self. Because it's seeing yourself separate from totality once again, or from God, you know, or whatever it is that we want to put there about ultimate truth and reality. So this is the whole point, and this is done by seeing how it is that actually there's no separation like that in the first place. To the extent that we see that, the personal agenda drops away. Has to come up again a little bit. I mean, in the sense of if you got a job, you got to go to work. Sure, you got to take care of things, put gas in the car, and buy the groceries, and you know, those kinds of things. But the other stuff about the excess that goes on beyond that, we all know what that is. I mean, where you're trying to force others to behave in a certain way, or to do this or do that, force yourself, make ourselves and others miserable. This is what drops away. And that teaching that you said can be seen as if it's in that very area that's actually got to do the dropping, you know. So this is one that, once again, what I was saying too, that I think over time we can learn to convey these teachings in a way that's clear. So there's ambiguity in that way of looking at it. It's not clear. I think we can clarify this and clarify it and clarify it. So I think the teachings themselves, of course, what we do too with religion, with religious teachings, especially, we freeze them. We freeze them in documents. This is one of the other things that I, you know, so the way they were talking about it 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, is like, this still applies today. And we're talking about cows and camels and, you know, things that don't even relate to, you know. No, the teachings themselves can really apply to today. And we can find subtleties, you know. It isn't a frozen thing, but of course, if you believe that this is a teaching that came down in a frozen way, there it is. Once again, there's separation, you know. And I would say that that's a very gross misunderstanding of spiritual teaching, spiritual thought. And it's very dangerous because it's the kind of stuff that keeps us acting in such so many I want to say silly, but it's more than, it's not just silly, it's downright dangerous ways. Fighting, wars, pollution, because you got the polluter you're making the money, and they don't really, you know, I mean, it goes on in so many different ways it expresses itself. But I do think that, yeah, the different traditions, yeah, they can, we find the little intimations of the understanding is in there. But I think the teachings have to evolve. One of the things I did like about Buddhism too, once again, is that this mechanism of evolution, change, and development of the teaching is built into it. The Buddha didn't really, his teaching wasn't some revealed teaching from on high. It was a human being looking at this and working it out and expressing it and say, find your own way. You look at this too and see for yourself. And so we have 500 years later, Nagarjuna coming along and clarifying that, because it wasn't being well understood. Why should that process stop? Vasubandhu, you know, a few centuries later, also works, you know, clarifies it in some way. And then others, this teaching of totality I just spoke of now, I came along later still. But this process can continue on. It doesn't need to stop. But I think humankind, we're getting to a point that is becoming really quite critical, because we have acquired the ability now to annihilate ourselves. We didn't have this before. I have a book called The End of the World, and it lists 31 different ways where we're very likely headed for extinction. It's like when you put all these together, it's like a near certainty. But you know, and really, you look at it, it's a Harvard study. I mean, this isn't silliness. You know, it was a real careful study. But 24 of the 31 things listed are things that we're doing. And we're doing it through our own ignorance and stupidity and small pettiness of mind. You know? So this is why I say, well, can we learn to behave before we let this kind of... coupling now our lack of understanding about our true situation here, couple that with our profound technology and our ability to wage war and, you know, diseases and crime and pollution and all that, it's just... Well, anyway, I think I made my point. I better stop. And we probably have run out of time, huh? I must have used 8 minutes doing that. I don't want to make this too late, so thank you.